So, David.
Oh, Michelle.
So, you know, I talked about how last app that we had someone exciting, potentially.
He's sitting right opposite me.
I know. Just try not to drool, please.
I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, yeah. Look, we'll get into who it is very shortly. Yeah. But, you know, we've been talking about whistleblowers. And I know that this is probably someone we definitely want to speak to.
Totally.
It's like in the wheelhouse of the things that we talk about. It's very exciting. You're listening to I Spy, the whistleblower of Australian intelligence. Well, it's less of a whistle and more of a...
It's a party whistle!
Oh. I don't really know if it's that kind of...
Come on, everything I say is flippant and party kind of.
Okay. Hello and welcome to I Spied. My name's Michelle Stevenson. I'm here with David Callan. Now, we kind of teased it earlier, but we do have someone. We talk about whistleblowers all the time.
Yeah, we do. And the thing is, I've been wanting to talk to a whistleblower for a long time.
I know, literally a whistleblower.
I'm a little scared about talking to whistleblowers because I don't know if they want to talk. But funnily enough...
Apparently this one does.
Also, the fact that they blew a whistle means they... do want to talk.
I'll bring our whistleblower in. David McBride, military lawyer, served in Afghanistan, turned whistleblower. Now, you're facing trial, so very unusual circumstances that we're able to have you here. And look, you're charged. Well, I mean, what is the formal charge?
Oh, there's five.
Okay.
I don't even know them myself.
I do. One for unauthorised disclosure, one for theft of Commonwealth property, and three for breaches of the Defence Act.
Okay.
Right. So now, of course, because I'm a reader, and also you're not just a former lawyer for the Army, not former Army officer, both in the Australian Army and the British Army, not just a former tracker on the UK version of Hunted, was it?
No, you didn't read out of the book. We left that out. So you've done your research.
Yeah.
He loves doing a deep dive.
But you're also an author, and you've written a new book, which is about to come out. I've had the privilege of reading it.
Yes, The Nature of Honour.
The Nature of Honour, Son, Duty-Bound Soldier, Military Lawyer, Truth Teller, Father.
So welcome and thank you so much for coming here. We're very excited to have you. We talk about a lot of this stuff. It's kind of in our wheelhouse.
Yeah.
But I guess what I want to get through is how about we start from the beginning because, you know, I'm sure this has taken quite a toll on you and it's been quite a journey. How did we get here? What was the thing that made you go, okay, I've had enough. I'm going to share what I know.
Well, that's the end, Michelle. That's not
exactly
the beginning.
But you start there in the book. That's very interesting. You do start.
I do start there to try and make it a little bit dramatic.
And the problem is I'm only three quarters of the way through, so I don't know the end.
Okay, well, how about we start with that, with what I just asked, and then we can weave it on backwards.
It's difficult. What I saw was they'd gone too far with what I believe the politicisation of the Defence Force. I believe the whole war in Afghanistan had become a bit like selling photocopiers or something like that. We were making up false heroes. We were making false villains. Our allies were hopeless. We were losing the war and pretending to win. It had become like, Enron, the famous failed corporation, a Ponzi scheme of a war. Yeah, I wasn't going to be a part of it. It took a while. It took a while because obviously to begin with, there's an element of accepting that things are not going to be perfect in any organisation that you're a member of. But eventually I had seen enough where I just thought, no, someone has to stand up. And it, if not now, when, and if not me, who? And... So, yeah, and I'll go into the exact – it'll take a while to talk about the exact incident, which made me think that. But we'll probably have to go back a little bit.
Okay, let's go back.
Rewind. How far back?
Yeah, well,
convicts?
Can I just get some context here? Let's get a bit of context because as you've said, I've read the book, and it's a really good book. One of the things I love about it is the chapters aren't too long. So it's one of those ones
We love a brief chapter.
You can punch through.
Yeah.
But you studied law at UCID, then you studied law at Oxford, which, I mean, my God, you're a double degree lawyer, which is incredible. Then you joined the British Army, served in Ireland, served in Germany. So you've got this incredible military career. Then you came back to Australia and became a barrister, and then you started working for the Army Reserve as a lawyer, and then finally joined the Australian Army as a legal representative for the SASR. Is that correct?
That is correct. You used to be a spy or something because you are very good retention of information.
He holds a lot of information. Sometimes it's not even useful.
Yeah, trust me, don't ask me
this. It's a computer inside that head.
Yeah. He loves doing a deep dive. He doesn't have friends, so he spends a lot of time doing research.
Exceptionally patient wife and children. So, look, one of the things that came out, the whole thing was the release of the material to the ABC. Now, that would have taken cojones because one of the things that I would have thought first is you would have approached the department saying, this is going on and we need to address it. And you did do that, and yet the department seems to have done nothing until the Brereton report.
Yeah, like that's right. And that's one of the problems with being a whistleblower. And the way the legislation is written, it's not realistic because the first thing you have to do is to take it to your bosses. And if it's a really big thing, of course they know and of course they're part of it. And so they're not going to go, oh, yeah, you're right, we're guilty. Put the cuffs on us. They're going to say, no, there's nothing to see here.
Yeah.
And not only that, when you go to the media after that, which the Act actually envisages is possible, they know exactly who's done it because the documents you were talking about are suddenly online.
Hang on a minute.
It rings a bell. Yeah.
So you did go and see and speak to someone?
Because I had a good career and I didn't want it to throw it out the window. So no. I made a very diplomatic, legalistic sort of complaint because I said, look, basically, I tried to give them an out because obviously if you don't give people an out, they've got no choice but to go for you. But to say, I understand it was a war and we may have pushed the envelope a little bit and got a bit carried away about what the truth. And because it was war and we had various things, that may be forgivable. But do we want to have a good look at this? And, as diplomatically as I possibly could, and I listed five incidents where I thought we had lied or stretched the truth or, fudged things in order for the political outcome. Now, they didn't take very kindly to that. But, I mean, I did try to do it as diplomatic. There was something inside of me, maybe overly optimistic now in retrospect, that was hoping that they might say, yeah, look, we see your point. And we're going to do things differently next time. But they didn't. But at least that gave me that some sort of fig leaf of protection to say, look, I did try to do it internally.
Mm-hmm.
And like that is going to be, we've just been going through my initial complaint because that's kind of going to be the sort of key document in my defence. It's about 20 pages long and it's got a couple hundred pages attachments to it. So, and I haven't read it for like 5 years at least. And I was quite surprised the other day reading it again that it does actually make sense. It's relatively technical, but it reads relatively well. I put many months into preparing and I had to do it in my spare time and I spent a lot of late nights at work preparing it, which of course made everybody feel very nervous because they knew I was preparing a sort of detailed complaint and everybody's wondering whether they're going to be mentioned in it. But it is... Yeah, I know. I was pretty happy with it. And that's going to be discussed in the case, whether or not it's ever going to become public knowledge. I don't know.
So you've got this information. How did you come across this information? Is it just because I would imagine that these things kind of come out, but they don't really want everyone to know that this stuff is going on?
Yeah, well, that's right. The first things that really bothered me, I was actually in Afghanistan. I was the lawyer on, because there's quite a few different lawyers in special forces, and I was the headquarters lawyer back in Canberra for a couple of years, and then I went as the SASR commando lawyer on the ground in Afghanistan.
So it's Kandahar?
No, in Terengkot. Good guess. Kandahar is the headquarters. That's where our bosses were.
Mm.
That was going to be another alternative to my. Named my book, The Kandahar Ski Club, in a kind of ironic way, but you would have got, but most people wouldn't have got. So I saw something on the ground and I thought that is so wrong. Well, it was a combination of politics and what happened on the ground. And then I started researching stuff. One of the things about a lawyer is you have the highest security clearance,
right. But
you've got to see everything. So I didn't have to do any hacking. I just had to sort of pull up files, which I was entitled to see on the system. And that's one of the things I did, you know, for many months, is looking for files which to me didn't seem right, and looking for patterns. And so I had the ability to pretty much look through every single, anytime someone was killed, anytime there was any major major incident, there's some sort of paper trail. And so I would look through all the paper trails and I tried to see patterns. One thing I didn't have was access to what the minister's people were saying. And that's one of the reasons why I first saw the journalists. I was hoping it was going to be more like all the president's men, the sort of Watergate scenario where I would have two very clever journalists who would start hunting around for the missing pieces.
But journalists aren't clever, let me just caveat that.
Certainly the days of Bernstein and Woodward seem to be long gone.
We just do a lot of Googling and hopefully something comes up.
Find a guy in a blanket fort to do all your reading for you.
Have lunches,
yeah.
So it didn't quite, my romantic
the idea wasn't quite there,
No. Those days are gone.
They are well and truly gone. Look, there are some great journalists, but the problem is it's been, you know, successive years of underpaying and carving out the importance
absolutely.
Of journalism.
A friend of my lawyer is an ex-journalist and he says that, and he says it is so gutted. And
we're just gutted.
One of the things that's very apparent in the book is your feelings towards the politicisation of defence. Now, I read somewhere that was more, well, it wasn't so much the war crimes going on in Afghanistan that was your main concern. It was actually what was going on in the upper echelons of defence. But the ABC took that you gave them and found the war crime stuff to be obviously more titillating for an audience. But that's the thing that has you most concerned, isn't it?
That's exactly right. That's what few people know. And and it takes – you need to have a fairly sophisticated audience like your audience.
Oh, did you hear that, guys? You're sophisticated. You're class. Class.
I don't know how we got here. I really don't.
To get that. People who – if they listen to I Spy, they're obviously interested in a little
deeper level. They do actually listen and understand. They school us sometimes.
Yes, and they often send us things. And if you want to send us things, you can do that at I Spy Podcast on Twitter.
Yep.
I wouldn't recommend that. And I'll follow you on Twitter now, but that is that's exactly right. And that was one of the issues I had with the ABC. Well, it's not the ABC so much. Unfortunately, of course, they're owned by the government. And the government, a bit like the fall of Singapore, if the government wants them to toe the line, all they have to do is turn the money off.
Mm.
And there's going to be no bad government stories. And that's one of the things that we've had since, again, sort of higher level stuff since Watergate. I think the US learnt some, good lessons, bad lessons, whichever way you want to look at it. But they realise you control the media, you control the war.
Yeah.
And now the idea that there would be, people will run bad soldier stories, but the idea they'll run a bad government stories, you know, it's very, very rare that that would ever happen, if maybe even impossible. So trying to get a major media company who rely on the government for tax or licenses and have lunch together with, you know, they're not really going to, they're reluctant to run a bad government story unless they've got a particular minister maybe they want to target. But generally they're focused what is sexy. And that's one of the things about, another one, the problems about being a whistleblower. There's an assumption that you take your papers to the journalist and it's suddenly going to be front page news and you're going to get the result that you wanted. But that's just not the way it works. They look at it, they try and decide whether it's saleable, whether or not it's going to run. First I was a bit angry about that, but then I can see that's just the way it works. They've got to sell copy. They can only think what is the public going to want, what does my bosses want, and that's not everything. And so you've got to weigh that up about what they're going to consider. I mean, if you could have a really good story about nuclear waste being dumped somewhere, but if it's too technical and the journalists don't think anyone's going to understand it, no one will run it.
Yeah, well, nuclear waste really isn't very sexy.
No.
But a nuclear submarine, that is sexy.
So
so sexy.
That's right.
So the information was found to be credible in the Brereton report. So how did that kind of make you feel I mean, in terms
well,
like that you.
Well, as David said, I mean, half. Because I said that, you know, that the leadership had a lot to do with it. And the thing about Brereton is it's kind of said the leadership had nothing to do with it.
Well, I mean, we all know that the army's a top-down approach. Mm. So it's very interesting that they said it had nothing to do
with it. Well, that's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that's what you get taught in day one.
Yes.
Is that if anything goes wrong, even if it's perhaps not your direct fault, the people at the top have to take the fall.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
That didn't happen.
That is something that you feel is one of the major problems going on in France.
I think it's a huge major problem. You know, I'd rather see one general have to answer some hard questions than 50 corporals.
Yeah, and I think that that is one of the things that a lot of people have kind of been questioning around this as well, because we all know that armed forces are a kind of top-down approach and they kind of set the standard, and what does get passed as normalcy or we can get away with this or we can do this has to be set at some point by someone higher up.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, look, you know, David Hurley is the Governor General now. He's been rewarded, you know. It may have just been, I don't think it's fair that he's sitting in Government House with all servants and things, and a lot of corporals and privates are really under a lot of pressure. Now, maybe he is blameless, but you would have thought he would have to come in and explain under cross-examination in the same way they all had to do for Brereton. I mean, I would like to see it just standardised pressure placed on those at the top and those at the bottom, and in fact the minister as well. I mean, Stephen Smith's over in London. The problem is that the senior leadership basked in the glory of the Special Forces for a long time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, you can't have it both ways. You can't sort of like pin medals on and get that bump in the polls when things are going well and then just run for cover and just throw people to the wolves when things go bad. If you've been there on the up, you need to be there on the down as well. And I think most of your listeners would agree with that. I mean, it's not a matter of putting anyone in jail so much, but it's just a matter of getting people to answer questions about who knew what when and what they did to prevent it.
And I think also, like, for a very long time, and why a lot of people were so surprised and probably why it took so long for people to kind of investigate and want to dig deep into it, is because we've always been proud of the way our armed forces have carried themselves overseas. They've always been, you know, kind of the peacemakers,
yeah.
And they've always been the ones that have never really got their hands dirty or really, you know, would be seen like, you know, the diggers.
We're the good guys.
We were the good guys. And I think that kind of the Brereton Report and a lot of this stuff has kind of changed the way that we perceive our diggers and our armed servicemen. And that is kind of a bit of an issue because Australia took, I mean, Anzacs, we do Anzac Day. We're very like pro, do you know what I mean? So I can see why there is that kind of pushback. But at the end of the day, no one is bigger than, you know, human rights. No one is bigger than making sure that we our servicemen carry themselves in a way that is professional. And I think it takes absolute bravery to be the person to go, you know what, this is not right. And if you had not have seen that and seen those patterns, do you think any of this would have come to light?
Yeah, look, I don't think so. And others think that as well, in that I was the first squeaky wheel to say, look, I'm going to do something. They knew I'd given something to the press, probably. They worked it out, but they wouldn't have known what. And I think they went into a bit of a panic and said, we need to get ahead of this, because it is all run like a highly cynical PR department. And they would have said, we need to get ahead of this. And I think I forced their hand with Brereton, that they did it in response to the fact that I was already talking.
Well, there was the Krompwirtz report, which was the sociologist who went and interviewed the SAS. Then there was the Trumbull report? All of these different reports led into Brereton, but do you believe that you're the squeaky wheel, that basically you're the finger that was pulled out of the dam and the water started to leak through?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because I took the raw documents. One of the things that I pointed out, I said, hang on, and in the Ben Robert Smith defamation trial, some of the tangential things, apart from the sort of major allegations, but the tangential things are very interesting, again, for the tragics who like all the details. Andrew Hastie, who was a captain in the SAS before he became a politician, he said he complained about Ben Robert Smith in 2012/2013. Now, a number of corporals also complained in end of 2012 when Ben Robert Smith got a leadership commendation or something, and they said, really? And military leadership say they knew nothing. But, I mean, these people complained. And then in 2013, they started investigating anything. And that's actually what got my interest up. I said, because in 2013, going back to the very beginning of the interview, said what sparked it. It was actually the investigation of a guy who had clearly just been defending himself. And they were trying to put him in jail for murder. And I was like, really? You know, this guy's not even within the parameters of a murder investigation and you are hanging him out to dry, and yet we've had all these allegations, credible 39 murder incidents the year before, and you didn't investigate one of them. Something as strange as going on. It looked like they knew something was up, the complaints. It looks to me, my case theory is that they heard Hastie's complaint, they heard the corporal's complaint. They knew something was up and they thought, shit, we need to get some scapegoats and we need to get them fast.
Yeah.
And that was what made me start looking into it, to say the political winds had changed. They saw that the writing was on the wall and they said, shit, we need to look like we take this seriously. So just arrest anybody except famous people, because that will bring everything down. But arrest some non-entities and that will clear us in the eyes of the media. You know, we'll look like we really care. And highly cynical, and most people, you know, a lot of my contemporaries were like, oh, why do you care, you know? So some non-entity gets chucked in jail, and too bad, you know, so sad. He should have known that, you know, when he was getting, but that just wasn't good enough for me. You don't put good people in jail to make up for bad people just because the politicians want it, you know. That's just not how it works if you're a professional soldier. And that's that sort of politicization to say, oh, we need a scapegoat. Doesn't matter whether he's guilty or not. And so I started looking into it. And the more I looked into it, the change was quite obvious between 2013 when the complaints were first, 2012, sorry, when the complaints were first made, to 2013 when they started going on this sort of hunt for scalps. And I thought, what's happened? You know, something happened. And that's what I wanted some journalists to look into, say, does anybody in the ministers, is there any evidence, smoking gun emails in the minister's office to say that they put out some sort of signal to say we need scapegoats?
Mm. Was there a trail? Did you find a trail of those complaints that Hastie and et cetera had kind of said this is happening? Because I would imagine they would have had a trail.
No, I didn't. I don't have that. I've only got a lot of what they call circumstantial case, but it doesn't look great for them. And since I'm the defendant, they have to prove beyond reasonable doubt that I'm wrong. And so that's some advantage that I've got.
Well, there is the public interest disclosure legislation, which should, by ways and means, kind of sanction this. However, there is it can be exempted for national security reasons. The thing is, now this is all out. One of the things that I find interesting about it is it's all out now. So where's the beef? What's the problem here?
Yeah, of course. And that's the problem with the whole national security exemption, is that the government gets to decide what's that, you know, well, at least they get to put forward. And it could be just, you know, the Prime Minister's killed his wife and they can say, look, that's national security. And it's very hard to say that's not really national security. Mm. It's just embarrassing. But they are. That is going to be the big question in the trial. They're going to, but you're right to say, and most people in the Australian public see this, to say this is a war that was fought 10 years ago and it's about people getting killed on mountaintops in windswept places. How could that possibly be something? You know, it's embarrassing, sure, but is it really national security? I don't think so.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I found interesting too with the Ben Robert Smith stuff, regardless of people, well, the judge finding that, you know, there is no question in the judge's mind that he did commit a lot of these atrocities, that people were still coming to his defence, and, you know, that's kind of hard to kind of get people to change the way they feel about someone who they believe is a war hero. But most of it has to do with the fact that they're like, well, this is war. This stuff happens. Why do we care?
Yeah, I get that a lot. And people say, you know, and quite reasonable, likable people say, you know, oh, what happens overseas?
Stays overseas. It's not Vegas, mate. It's not Vegas. We're not at the craps table and picking up strippers.
I know. This is and I get where they're coming from. I think they're trying to say, you know, our soldiers go through
Yes, of course they do.
And it's great to see that people support, you know, our, but I think it's summed up best by one of the key witnesses against him, who was an SAS sergeant himself. And so those people are slightly misunderstanding it. It's not, you know, the latte set from Leichhardt against Ben Robert Smith. It's another SAS sergeant who's just as brave, who's done just as many operations, and who has said he went too far.
Mm.
And this guy in this quote I was thinking of, he even implies, he doesn't say it, of course, but he even implies to say, look, we all shot people, perhaps we shouldn't have, but BRS took it too far and was, you know, taking people around the back and blowing their brains out. And that was wrong. That's coming from an SAS guy.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, that's not coming from a journalist. And that's why I support them, because they are – the witnesses are other SAS people. I mean, they're people that put their life on the line just as much and did all the selection and were just as brave and the sort of people that are going to come and save you. So it's not a matter of journalists versus soldiers. It's
soldiers.
It's soldiers who have stood up and again, at the cost, severe cost for them. I mean, it must be very, very hard. And I'm sure none of them particularly wanted to be in that courtroom. They'd rather be out there defending the country, and I take my hat off to them. It's not very easy, and yet they did it because they thought it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, and just as hard for someone like you. But I want you to stay there. Don't go anywhere, because we're going to keep you around for another app, I think.
Put him in the fridge.
Keep him on ice.
Keep him on ice.
And we'll talk a little bit more about the trial and the toll that's kind of taken on you and your family and, you know, kind of the wounds the government doesn't really want opening. So you don't go anywhere.